Hi there, dolls, music lovers, and fashion enthusiasts. Welcome to Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s, the podcast that takes you on a groovy journey through the lives and legacies of the incredible women who shaped these iconic decades. We are your hosts, Emma
and Abby,
and together we'll explore the stories behind the music, the fashion, and the cultural revolution that defined an era.
Each episode will shine a spotlight on a remarkable woman, from rock and roll rebels to fashion icons, and dive into their impact on the world. We'll uncover the historical context, chat with experts, and celebrate the lasting influence of these trailblazing ladies. So, grab your bell bottoms and get ready to rock and roll as we uncover the untold stories of dolls who left their mark. Let's dive in.
So there is a Beatles biopic announced, and we just have to talk about it. What are, like, your first thoughts and feelings? Because we don't know much yet.
I will say that when rumors of the casting were first swirling, and I'd say December, my reaction was, please say psych. I don't particularly want any of these actors playing any of these Beatles, and here we are.
I have to find words, you know? Because one thing that is a little absurd to me is that the career of the Beatles was done before anyone reached 30. And all of these actors are in their 30s, and I think they, some have more resemblance than others to the Beatles that they're about to portray, but none of them look like they're 20. And so I think it's an odd choice of casting, and it's also odd to me because I feel like oftentimes with biopics, okay, like the Bob Dylan biopic did not do that, but a lot of biopics use very unknown actors. And I think it is an interesting choice to go with these very well-known, very recognizable faces. And I think that's not necessarily a good thing.
I think that's the one place where the Brian Epstein biopic went right, was casting unknowns for the Beatles, who were age-appropriate.
Yes. Now, yes, Paul Mescal, he does kind of look like Paul McCartney, but not that much that it makes me forget who it actually is. And so I feel like if it was a face that I've never seen before, I would be like, I could adjust to them portraying him. I'm very excited about the director choice, because Sam Mendes is about to direct this, and he has directed some incredible films. I really liked 1917 from a couple of years ago.
That was him.
Incredible film. That was him. So I'm excited in that sense. I also heard that they're doing 4 films.
Yes.
And that's, like, gonna be a hell of a work.
That's very ambitious.
Yes. I mean, most likely they're gonna, like, chop the Beatles' history into, like, 4 chapters. What if they're telling the same story out of each perspective? And every film is, like, the same thing, but told from someone else's perspective. I think it's too experimental for what they're actually trying to do. But when I heard it was 4 movies, I was like, that's an interesting idea.
There are definitely going to be some events that line up.
Yeah,
between probably more than one film, if not all 4.
There's no more cast released so far. I'm excited who's, like, gonna be Patty Boyd, who's gonna be Brian Epstein. There are so many more.
Who's gonna be Yoko?
Who's gonna be Yoko, yeah. That's, like, a whole new thing. Joseph Quinn as George Harrison. First of all, I don't see any resemblance there. Maybe the hair and makeup is gonna work some sort of magic, but he's also so known as Eddie Munson. That is, like, it was his breakthrough role.
My hair twin.
But this was, like, his big role, his big break. And, like, how are they gonna retell him as George Harrison? I don't know if that's gonna be happening.
That'll be interesting.
We'll see.
You know what biopic I'm really excited for? I am really excited for Jeremy Allen White playing Bruce Springsteen. I cannot wait.
Yes, because the pictures are so good. Because they went with a very known actor, but an actor who looks
age appropriate.
Yes, that, and who looks a whole fucking lot like Bruce Springsteen. I saw him in that one flannel. There was, like, pictures from the set, and I was like, this is gonna work out perfectly. This might be his Oscar chance. He's a very beloved actor too, and I think he has done enough things for where he's not as tied to a certain character. I think this is actually a really interesting thing when talking about actors breaking free from like that one role you're so known for. The only actor I wasn't too familiar with from the new cast of the Beatles film is the guy playing John Lennon.
Same.
He's like the less known to me. I have no idea what he was in. I haven't done a lot of research.
Sorry to like hard left turn the subject, but Emma, do you know what day it is today? As of us recording this?
I knew that you were going to bring this up. It is April 1st.
April 1st!
April Fool's Day. And this marks the 1 year anniversary of like the first thought of this podcast. Because a year ago today, I reached out to Abby and she thought it was an April Fool's joke. And I was like, hey, want to do a podcast? And she was like, I think this is a joke.
Well, it's not. We're here.
2 seasons in. It wasn't a joke.
And I'm very, very happy it wasn't a joke because this show has been a blast.
Me too. It's been so great. I also cannot believe that we're approaching our 1 year recording anniversary.
Yeah, that'll be in May.
That's not that long.
I don't have a good lead in.
That's fine.
What are you even looking for?
Madonna, Blondie, Bowie, Beatles, music! We need music!
This is music!
Let's start this episode with a song. If you've spent any time on TikTok, that song will surely sound familiar to you. That was Remember Walkin' in the Sand by this week's group, The Shangri-Las. I've been scouring for their records ever since I heard them on TikTok too. No one is immune to the power of TikTok. We played one of their songs on our Hippie Hour guest spot. It's safe to say we're fans. Once Lisa McKinney's Dressed in Black, The Shangri-Las and Their Recorded History was announced, this here book, I ordered a copy. And this episode wasn't supposed to be out for another month, but I guess some of the pre-orders were accidentally sent out early because I got mine 10 days before release. Someone probably got fired for that. To that person, I am very sorry, but hey, it means I could fast track this episode, so it's all good. We also used Laura Flom and Emily Sue Leibowitz's But Will You Love Me Tomorrow, an oral history of the 60s girl groups, and a handful of other books in my collection that are always listed in the episode notes. Let's take it away.
Perfect. Betty Weiss was born November 27th in 1946 to parents Harry and Elizabeth. She had an older brother, George, born in 1940. Her younger sister Mary, born on December 28, 1948. Mary would be the youngest of the Shangri-Las. Through Mary and Betty's early childhood, Elizabeth worked as a secretary at an insurance firm, while Harry was a telephone line splicer. He was often suspended high in the air to work. While Betty had memories of her father, Mary didn't. In February of 1949, when she was just 6 weeks old, Harry died in a tragic accident at work. Quote, he worked for the phone company and they found him dangling from a pole. Since Harry didn't think to have a life insurance policy while working such a dangerous job, Elizabeth, George, Betty, and Mary were left in poverty. Elizabeth worked odd jobs to get by, relying on welfare, handouts, and favors to make ends meet. It was, quote, a hell of a way to grow up, as Mary said. She implied her and her siblings had to grow up too fast in the wake of their father's death, as Elizabeth just couldn't cope. Quote, we had to raise my mother. Through her troubled childhood, music was always Mary's outlet. Quote, I always kind of supported myself. It was a question of survival, and I always sang. I sang since I could talk. She heard the Ink Spots on the radio as a kid and lifted Elvis albums from her brother's record collection. When she was 14, she saw the Everly Brothers for the first time at Freedom Land in the Bronx, a U.S. history-themed amusement park.
Bye-bye, my love, goodbye. There goes my baby. with someone new. She sure looks happy, I sure am blue.
We were just talking about amusement parks before this.
Yes, I was just thinking about that.
There's, oh man, this place is quite infamous in U.S. history. But there's this theme park called Holy Land.
Okay.
It's kind of a landmark, and it is a Bible-themed, or was, a Bible-themed amusement
park.
That
is such an American thing to me.
It's since been closed down. I don't know if the city owns it now or like a nunnery, but what's still there, and this is the landmark that everybody talks about when you're driving on this highway, at night, the giant cross is still there, and it lights up.
Wow.
It's neon colors, Emma. It's, depending on the day, it's either white, purple, or green, and it's just this neon cross on top of a mountain. It's crazy.
That is such an American thing to me.
Yeah.
Like, church is a thing here, too, but, like, it's a very, in a very conservative way. Like, you go into a church, it's just beautiful, it's, like, several centuries old. But the thought of, like, a neon cross, that wouldn't fly here. But it's so funny. It's so cool, though.
And I mean, it is a pretty funny landmark. Like, oh, you just stay on the highway for this long, and when you see the giant f***ing neon cross, get off on exit whatever.
Twin sisters Mary Ann and Marguerite Ganser were born in Laurelton on February 4th, 1948, to parents Rita and Herman. They had two brothers, Robert and Fred, and a sister, Gail. Rita played piano and sang at nightclubs when she was younger. Robert says she is where the twins got their musical talent from. Both Margie and Mary Ann showed an early talent for music. They sang, took 7 years of piano lessons, and were trained in music theory and composition. Margie wrote some songs in her early teens, while Mary Ann picked up the guitar. The Weisses and Ganser settled in the Cambria Heights neighborhood of Queens. Cambria Heights cropped up in the post-war housing boom, promoted as an affordable neighborhood for young, white, upwardly mobile families. Residents were mostly Jewish or children of immigrants, including the future Shangri-Las. The Ganser girls were grandchildren of Austrian immigrants to Canada, while the Weisses were Jewish. Through the early to mid-1960s, Cambria Heights slowly but surely integrated. This process wasn't without incident. The New York Times described Andrew Jackson High School, where the Shangri-Las went, as being, quote, rocked by clashes between white and Negro students. And the first black families to move to Cambria Heights faced constant harassment and discrimination. With them, they brought what the music industry still considered black music. R&B and doo-wop. These two genres would be major influences on the Shangri-La sound. Since the Gansers and Weissens lived just a couple of blocks away from each other, the girls of course became friends. They sang harmony at each other's houses, on the playground, and even in the streets, with Betty on lead. They started performing in earnest when Betty was about 14, Mary Ann and Margie were 13, and Mary was just 12. The Weiss's brother, George, was their manager. He was more of like a chaperone than anything else. They sang at birthday parties, sock hops, and school dances, practicing harmony and choreography all the way. They didn't play in bars or clubs, as was long assumed. They weren't even old enough to get in.
And this wasn't a situation like the Ronettes, where they could do their makeup and look older. No, Mary was very obviously a 12-year-old.
Yes. 12 is very obviously young.
As the recording industry boomed through the late 50s and early 60s, it became increasingly common for talent scouts to go to school dances and hops to find fresh-faced talent. That's exactly what happened to the Shangri-Las. In late 1962 or early 63, the notorious Artie Rip spotted them performing in Queens. They were quickly signed to Kama Sutra Records. There was just one thing. They didn't have a name yet. Not until they were on the way to record their first song. They looked out the window of the car and passed a restaurant called the Shangri-La. It was as simple as that. They'd be called the Shangri-Las. The name sounded nice. It was different enough to stand out from a sea of girl groups whose names ended in ets. Freshly named, the Shangri-Las recorded their first demo, Simon Says.
Proudly present the dynamic Shangri-Las.
Hey.
The girls themselves hated Simon Says. Later on, Margie said it was a, quote, horrible record. It's really bad. Being very new in the field, we figured it was going to be a great big hit and didn't see anything wrong with it technically. Their next single, Wishing Well, met a similar fate. Things were looking bleak for the Shangri-Las until they landed an audition for producer George Shadow Morton. George was quite the character. He insisted upon wearing dark sunglasses and a trench coat wherever he went, and earned the nickname Shadow from his habit of disappearing from parties without saying goodbye. Songwriter Ellie Greenwich described George as moody and eccentric, wanting to be like Phil Spector. In one session, he insisted he wanted more thunder on the record. More purple. Give me more purple!
Oh, man.
When asked about him in interview with Susie Quattro, Mary simply said he was a maniac. Strange as George was, the man was brilliant and 100% less evil than Phil Spector. He saw the girls' potential. They could sing, they had a stage presence, and they could even act a little bit. A one-of-a-kind group, two sisters and a set of twins, needed a one-of-a-kind song. In early 1964, George got the Shangri-Las signed to a 5-year contract with Lieber and Stoller's Red Bird Records. If you'll remember from our episode about Ronnie Spector, Lieber and Stoller were the songwriting duo who mentored Phil Spector. After hearing his mutual friend Ellie Greenwich was signed to Lieber and Stoller's publishing company, George decided to pay her a visit at the famous Brill Building. Ellie's husband and co-writer, Jeff Barry, asked George what he did for a living. He replied, he, quote, wrote hit songs. According to him, this was a lie. He'd never written a song before. And the Shangri-La's first hit came from a bet. For a long time, people said, remember walking in the sand? Wow, that was so weird. How did you come up with that? I don't know. South Oyster Bay Road in a Buick? George went on a drive, scribbled up some lyrics about a girl and her summer fling, found a band, and brought in the Shangri-La's to sing. This is how George and Ellie always said Remember came about. Even George's obituary in the New York Times repeated that he'd never written a song before this one. But with a little research, Lisa McKinney discovered that not only had George written songs before, he was the lead singer of doo-wop group The Markies. Most of the time, George either downplayed or outright denied his musical background. In the rare instances he did go into detail about it, he intentionally named all of his groups wrong. However Remember really came out, the demo was 8 minutes long with a whole spoken word introduction by George. Ellie said, quote, I knew there was no way we could put out anything like that. But I thought, gee, that girl's voice is so strange. And the song is so interesting. She, too, heard something special in the Shangri-Las. She brought Remember to Lieber and Stoller, who gave them all the okay to record it. George's weird intro was cut, but Billy Joel's piano stayed. He just happened to be in that group of session musicians playing on the demo. But since he was only 15 and not in the union, he never got paid for his work that day. Billy was actually present for More Purple. It was his first session ever. He was so confused by the whole thing, like wondering, is this what recording music is like? Is everyone this insane?
Imagine being 15 and like stepping foot into a recording studio for the first time, and this is what you're walking into.
I would be terrified.
Me too.
Calling my mom.
Yeah, it's impressive he decided to stay in the industry after that. That isn't the end of the story of Remember. As the Shangri-Las worked on the song's arrangement with Ellie, who barged into the studio but Artie Rip. He demanded to know what they were doing with his group. The Shangri-Las' old contract with Kama Sutra was never dissolved. His own version of this story is much stranger. If George was strange, Artie Rip was strange and sketchy. According to Dressed in Black, it was an old music industry joke that the term rip-off was named after him. He signed Billy Joel to such a horrible contract, it essentially made him a slave of the label. It would take years to get out. He had to pay Artie to get away from him. Kama Sutra had sketchy origins as well. Their funding was secured from a capo of the Colombo crime family. Artie even said he was made a partner after another Kama Sutra exec burned a store down for the insurance money. According to Artie, After going through Kama Sutra's back catalog, he personally picked Remember to be recorded. He conveniently didn't mention George Morton, Ellie, or Jeff at all, but he did say he presented the single with Lieber and Stoller's third partner at Redbird, George Goldner. This all may seem random, but Goldner will become very important later. Recording contract or not, it was clear Artie, his partners, and the mob were going to get their way. They demanded they be credited on Remember. Their names are where Ellie and Jeff's normally would be on the disc's label. It was also clear this early on that the Shangri-Las would have little to no control over their own career. I feel like this is a very typical thing for 1960s groups, especially young girl groups. They had little to no control over what was actually happening. Remember Walking in the Sand was released in July of 1964. It entered the top 10 the week of September 12th and peaked at number 5. Walking in the sand, walking hand in hand. The night was so exciting, smile was so inviting. Then you touched my cheek. Remember, with his fingertips, softly, softly we'd meet with a lip. Whatever happened to the boy that I once knew? The boy who said it'd be true. Though they'd become local celebrities in Queens, having a record on the Billboard charts was nothing the Shangri-Las had ever seen before. Quote, "When you put out a record and it hits, you have to. So we were ill prepared for it. We kind of fudged our way through it." Their first appearance as the Shangri-Las, remember they didn't have a name before recording Simon Says, was on Clark Race's dance party show. They had little to no time or resources to prepare for what was coming, and neither did Redbird. But it was time to record the follow-up. This, of course, would be the fictional story of Betty and her tragic love, Jimmy, the leader of the pack.
Mm-mm. By the way, where'd you meet him? Yes, we see.
That's when I fell for the leader of the pack.
As the story goes, to get that famous motorcycle sound, George had someone drive a real motorcycle through a hotel lobby and up the stairs of the studio. Of course, the police were called and George got a ticket. In reality, it was probably a stock sound effect from their archives. I mean, John Lennon originally wanted to be hung up on his feet and swung around the studio to sing, so I've heard stranger things, but like, that is already pretty wild.
Imagine just working the front desk at that hotel and suddenly a motorcycle comes through.
The motorcycle rides through.
Like, do I call my supervisor in this situation? What do I do?
I bet if like whoever worked the front desk would have called their supervisor, they would assume that this is a joke.
Yes.
Like, imagine you're the supervisor, the phone rings and someone's like, what do I do?
Drove a motorcycle through our lobby.
Help.
Help. And there's this dude in a trench coat. I don't know what's happening here.
Oh man, the 60s were wild in any senses.
And this was before the psychedelics.
According to George, he wrote Leader of the Pack for another group. He tried to submit this other group, the Goodies, for consideration, but Redbird put the kibosh on that. They didn't want anything interfering with the Morton-Shangri-La's relationship, however new it was. Though he wrote it for someone else, George still had Mary in mind. Quote, "As I wrote the song, I heard Mary singing, and I saw Mary.
My folks were always putting him down. They said he came from the wrong side of town.
What do you mean when you say that he came from the wrong side of town?
They told me he was bad, but I knew he was sad. That's why I fell for the leader of the pack."
But Mary wasn't sure she wanted to sing it. The bad girl image was more mature than what she was comfortable with. It worked for the Ronettes, three sassy girls from Spanish Harlem, but Mary wasn't so sure if it worked for her. Ellie urged her to sing the song. She knew it would be a hit. Quote, "After the session, I knew it was a number one record. Chapel of Love by the Dixie Cups and Leader of the Pack were the only two I was dead sure about. Sure enough, Leader of the Pack hit number one the week of November 28th in 1964. The girl's outsider image appealed to fellow outsiders, the girls who chewed gum in class and wore their biker boyfriend's leather jackets. The song did well in Britain too, until the BBC banned it. Death Discs, or Splatter Platters as they were called, those early 60s moral songs where one or both lovers dies in an accident, were frowned upon here. So to recap, the song was sang by a group that wasn't supposed to sing it, has a motorcycle that wasn't supposed to be where it was on it, and it became a number one hit that wasn't supposed to be played. That's pretty punk. To promote Leader of the Pack, the Shangri-Las made an infamous appearance on the show I've Got a Secret. The whole thing is ridiculous. Mary has a huge false bouffant on her head, actor Robert Goulet plays Jimmy and makes all these James Dean pouty faces. Everyone there's trying so hard not to laugh at the absurdity of it all.
Have you seen it?
Yes. I read this in the script and I was like, I need to see this. It is wild. I highly encourage you, listeners, to watch it too, because it is so funny.
Something of it will probably be in the trailer, so I'm glad that we're kind of bringing it up again now.
I turned this into a game with my husband. We put it on, and we're like, whoever manages to not laugh the longest wins. And it was so hard, because it is so funny. It is so absurd. It almost feels like a skit. It feels like a skit of what these old TV appearances were, because a lot of the times they were really over the top, but this is like over the top in a very strange way.
Though all four Shangri-Las sang on all of their songs, they were a trio at all of their appearances. I didn't even know there were four Shangri-Las until I started researching this episode.
Me either.
That's because in 1964, before Remember and Leader of the Pack were even released, Betty Weiss discovered she was pregnant. At this time, being an unwed mother was a source of deep shame. Some would leave town to give birth and give their child up for adoption. Patti Smith talks about this in her book Just Kids. Sometimes, adoptions were forcible. On top of being unmarried, Betty was 17 and still in school, adding to the scandal. Thankfully, she was not made to give up her baby, but she was made to drop out of the Shangri-Las. Management told fans it was Betty's choice, to finish school or because she didn't like traveling. She married her child's father on July 27th, 1964, and gave birth to her daughter Tracy in early 65. It seems the marriage didn't last, as Betty raised Tracy with her brother George. Betty was allowed to rejoin the group after giving birth, but never again would she be lead singer or go on tour. Mary, just 15 years old at the time, took her sister's place as frontwoman. When asked where the drama in her performances came from, Mary cited the drama in her life. It was a combination of the heightened emotions all girls feel in their teens. Speaking from experience, the slightest thing could feel like the end of the world in those years.
Yeah.
It was sudden fame, being thrust into the spotlight after Betty's departure, and her tough childhood. Quote, "We grew up pretty poor, and I mean, I've been supporting myself since I was 14, so I don't know. There was a lot of pain in me." Where the girls had no control over who was in their group or what happened to their music, they had control of their look. Early press photos show them wearing long pleated skirts and blouses buttoned high. Mary was a tomboy. Quote, "I used to get my slacks on 8th Street in the Village in a men's store. People would look at me like I was gay because I like low-rise pants." The look we associate the Shangri-Las with today didn't come until the Leader of the Pack single cover. Mary stands defiantly in black skinny pants and boots in front of her Jimmy. Margie and Marianne back her up in matching outfits, like a girl gang. Though Mary always asserted the tough girl thing was just an act, Ellie Greenwich said it was genuine. Quote, "They were as they looked. They were tough, yet very vulnerable. I think that was part of the appeal. At the beginning, we did not get along. They were kind of crude, and having to deal with them on a daily basis used to get me very uptight, with their gestures and language and chewing the gum and the stockings ripped up their leg." Ellie mentioned the ripped stockings several times across different sources. She remembered the girls being so mean to her that they made her cry. This might have been the fight over singing Leader of the Pack. Teenage girls are so mean.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it was, they worked things out and had a wonderful working relationship moving forward. However true to life the bad girl thing was, it had a profound effect on the Shangri-La's fans. Lisa McKinney said, Did the average American girl wear black pants and boots, crave the company of delinquent biker types, fight with her parents, and reject their values? Almost certainly not. Maybe the black pants and boots didn't apply to every girl, but the feeling most certainly did. This tough image drew equal ire and fascination from men in the industry. Those who didn't understand what it was like to be a teenage girl wrote off their melodrama as frivolous, and wrote off a motorcycle in a song as gimmicky. Critic Greg Shaw had something absolutely wild to say about the Shangri-La's image in a documentary. Buckle up for this one. He likened them to, quote, tough sluts. I saw you roll your eyes. I had the same reaction. Mary was 15 when she sang Remember. It's bold to describe her as a tough slut when she might not have even had her first kiss yet.
Older men and the way that they perceive younger women, it makes me so mad. I don't know. For some reason, I just always think if it would have been the other way around, this would have never been okay. There is such a huge imbalance here, not only of age, but also of power and like everything else. But imagine being confronted with that as three or four young girls, and you're just, you have this huge dream of wanting to become a musician, and someone decides this is the image you're supposed to have now. Yeah. Through the rest of 1964, the Shangri-Las were regulars at two venues we've heard of before, the Brooklyn Fox and the Apollo Theater. The bill at the Fox was enormous. 15 acts, including Dusty Springfield, Martha and the Vandellas, The Temptations, Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, and the Supremes. It was a bit of an oddball pairing, all these Motown acts with these young white women. It was indicative of Dusty and the Shangri-Las' appeal to R&B listeners, and the fact that girl groups were often assumed to be black. When Mary met James Brown at the Apollo, quote, he turned around and looked. Here's this little blonde girl. He thought we were black. All the other performers were black, and we were very nervous because we didn't know how the audience was going to respond. It turned out to be a great show. Playing the Brooklyn Fox and Apollo were brutal, as we heard about in Ronnie's episode. The crowds were tough. With so many acts on any given bill, each group only had one or two songs to make an impression. The shows were run so tightly, there was hardly any time to eat or rest, let alone complete managerial requirements. Mary remembered, I'd go in the dressing room and he'd, meaning the manager, have somebody sitting in the corner. And I'm like, who are you? And he goes, I'm here to teach you Remember in French. And I'm like, you're out of your mind. A couple weeks after debuting at the Brooklyn Fox, the Shangri-Las scored a gig most any band in the 60s would want. They opened a charity concert with the Beatles. In just a few months, the Shangri-Las went from singing on the corner in Queens to opening for the biggest band in the world. Mary remembers taking part in pre-show antics to rile up the huge crowd of girls who gathered in hopes of spotting a Beatle. Quote, they put the Beatles on one floor and everybody else on another floor. Margie went up to a high floor and started sticking her fingers through the blinds to make the crowds go nuts in the streets. The Shangri-La schedule only got busier as their profile rose. On October 12th, which New York City named Shangri-La's Day, that year, they performed at the 1964 World's Fair. In November, they headed out to England for the first time to perform with the Searchers. In late December, they put out their next single, Give Him a Great Big Kiss.
When I say I'm in love, you best believe I'm in love, L.U.V.
Believe it or not, this was the second song taken from the Goodies. Though it was crushing for them, it landed the Shangri-Las another hit. They were named number one new vocal group of the year in Cashbox's final issue of 1964. With three hits under their belts now, the Shangri-Las started touring. They opened for James Brown, Chuck Berry, the Beach Boys, and even the Rolling Stones. And they played a lot of high schools. They came to author Jerry Hershey's school in Connecticut. This is some of what she remembered from the day. Quote, they looked out on a bland sea of Shetland sweatered boys named Dusty and Miles, preppies whose eyes popped at the sight of these chicks in poured on capris. Just outside the windows, the girl group's greaser Galaheads, the auto shop guys, the skinny loners in black chinos and Cuban heels, smoked, indifferent and cool. The group played to them, beckoning them in with shiny hot pink manicures. The cheerleaders in plaid skirts took a long look outside and wondered. Bad boys could be kinda cool? The cruel irony is, while the Shangri-Las played to high schools all over America, they themselves hardly went to school.
The Ganser twins dropped out of school when the Shangri-Las got big. Their mom, Rita, was strongly against it. Quote, I wanted them to finish high school. They wouldn't finish high school. They had another year to go, and they cried and cried because this talent scout came. Of course I had a fit. I didn't want them to do it. But they carried on, so they got their way. Betty Weiss likely had to leave school when she found out she was pregnant, leaving only Mary at Quintano's School for Young Performers. Quintano's was a high school just for teens in show business. The location was convenient, right across from Carnegie Hall. It boasted a unique approach to education, and it was accommodating to students' busy schedules. But by June of 1965, the state of New York questioned Quintano's academic qualifications. There was no library, gym, or science lab at the school, and tuition was incredibly expensive. Drug use was rife among students, with faculty unwilling to do anything about it. So long as the parents paid, the school turned a blind eye. Quintano's was eventually shut down when their diplomas were deemed worthless. I tried to find exactly when it closed, but even the New York State Department of Education's website didn't have a date listed, which just goes to show how unregulated this school was.
Do you know who is a very, very popular alumni from Quintano? Steven Tyler.
Really?
Yes, because when I read that, it kind of like rang familiar to me. And so I did some research and I was like, that is where I've read about this before. And he also said that like this school was basically a joke. No one really got any education.
Oh, no. No. American public school is enough of a free-for-all, speaking from experience. In the summer of 1965, the Shangri-Las embarked on Dick Clark's Caravan of Stars tour with the likes of the Zombies, Del Shannon, and the Iquettes. Not unlike Murray the K's shows at the Brooklyn Fox, it was like a sweatshop. The bus was cramped and chaotic. There was very little time to socialize, let alone sleep. The only time groups really socialized was to drink and take drugs, almost necessary to sleep and stay awake at odd hours between shows. This was likely where Marianne developed a drug problem. When the Shangri-Las toured by themselves, it was nothing like today. There were no roadies, assistants, or tutors to make sure Mary did her schoolwork. There wasn't even really a chaperone. There was no one to manage the girl's schedule. It was, here's a list of shows, get on the road. There weren't bodyguards either. After a crazed fan tried to break into Mary's hotel room, she bought a gun. You may be asking yourselves, where were the parents? Rita traveled with the girls early on, but after George Morton convinced her the girls would be okay with him, she let them go by themselves. Such a different attitude towards teenagers back then. You just stick them in the back of a flatbed truck, no seatbelts or anything. We're just going on a drive down the highway, no big deal.
It's kind of the same, like even 10 years later when the Runaways came around, it was still the same.
I noticed so many parallels between the Shangri-La's story and the Runaways. Did you?
That is interesting. Yeah, I mean, I don't know the Shangri-La stories as well because I have not read the biography. I'm definitely going to read it though. But I'm very familiar with the Runaways and like the biography Sherry Curry wrote. And I think it is very similar in a lot of ways. Also kind of like the idea that a manager picks up this group of young girls and kind of like dictates them on who they have to be. That really is like the familiarity for me between these two stories.
Through their time on the road, the Shangri-Las had a fun bunch of backing bands, because they didn't have their own. You never knew what you were getting, Mary said. Some of the backup used to sound like Bill Murray lounge lizard music, which used to drive us up the wall. It was unacceptable. I love her attitude in all of these quotes.
Yes.
On August 10th, 1965, the girls weren't backed by lounge lizard music, but they did have something close. In a suburb of Detroit, Michigan, they met the Fabulous Iguanas. Their drummer was one Jimmy Osterberg, aka the peanut butter flinging prince of chaos, Iggy Pop.
It is so wild how all of these people, like, all their stories are so intertwined in the weirdest way. Mm-hmm. Like, I would just encourage you to, whichever record comes to mind, look into who played on that. Look into the session musicians, and I swear someone has had an incredible career afterwards.
Quote, "I was terrified," guitarist Jim McLaughlin confessed. Not of playing with Iggy, but of playing with the girls. They didn't have much more of an hour of rehearsal with their, quote, "greasy lead guitar player slash manager slash roadie guy." McLaughlin babbled, "Which one is the candy store one? What are the chords? This is gonna be a disaster." The candy store one. Whatever happened at that gig, it certainly wasn't as disastrous as the night of April 30th, 1966. The Shangri-Las played the Spring Spectacular in Seattle alongside the Lovin' Spoonful and the Mamas and the Papas. Garage rock legends the Sonics were hired as the Shangri-Las backing band. You'd think this was a match made in heaven. Ass-kicking, bloody murder-screaming bad boys from Tacoma and the bad girls from Queens. It was anything but. The Sonics themselves called this infamous gig the Shangri-Las Incident. They blindly agreed to play before hearing any of the Shangri-Las songs, then never bothered to actually learn them. Naturally, they butchered the gig, playing during breaks and taking breaks where there weren't ones. Jerry Rosley egregiously pulled out the fake poison bottle he used for the Sonics song Strike Nine to ham it up during the part of Leader of the Pack where poor Jimmy dies.
As he drove away on that rainy night, I begged him to go slow. And what he heard, I'll never know.
It was a disaster. There's photos of them all together. You can see the tension all over their faces. This horrendous night might have been the girls' final straw. Soon after, they hired their own backing band.
Well overdue. Seeing the opportunity to make a quick buck off the Shangri-La's success, Smash Records reissued The Thorn in their sights. Simon says, Margie said, quote, "We would have given anything not to see it on the market again." To distract fans, they put out a cover of The Chantels' Maybe. Their first album, Leader of the Pack, was cobbled together to capitalize on their single success. With their matching black and white pantsuits and Mary's pin-straight hair, the Shangri-Las officially had an iconic look. Revlon took notice and in the spring of 1965 made the girls official spokeswomen of their Natural Wonder beauty line. They recorded a jingle, did a dating advice column, and promoted their swing stakes. The grand prize, a trip to London to meet the Dave Clark Five. They released their second album, The Shangri-La 65, in September of that year. It featured another one of their greatest hits, I Can Never Go Home Anymore.
Don't, 'cause you can never. Listen, does this sound familiar? You wake up every morning, go to school every day, spend your nights on the corner, just passing time away. Your life is so lonely, like a child without a toy. Then a miracle, a boy. And that's called glad. My mom is a good mom, and she loves me with all her heart. But she said I was too young to be in love, and the boy and I would have to part. And no matter how I ranted and raved, I screamed, I pleaded, I cried. She told me it was not really love, but only my girlish pride. And that's called bad.
Though it it's about a runaway's mother missing her daughter so much she dies of a broken heart, the song's theme of regretting growing up too fast was tragically relevant for the Shangri-Las. No one told the girls that the luxuries the label supposedly treated them to, fancy clothes, nice dinners, even a car, in fact came out of their own paycheck. Unfortunately, this was standard practice in the industry at the time, but no one told the girls or their parents about this. On top of that, they were in business with Artie Rip, known for running up $1,000 charges for parties and sex workers and billing them to his artists. The girls did eventually figure out their money was being stolen, but there was nothing they could do about it. On top of this, their label was about to crumble. George Goldner was still in the picture. He intentionally sabotaged a potential merger between Redbird and the much bigger Atlantic Records by, for lack of a better term, acting like an ass. He did this in hopes of eventually buying out Lieber and Stoller's shares in Redbird. In 1966, that's exactly what he did. But not without a little help. Remember the mob? That Kama Sutra investor involved with the Colombo family allegedly hung Jerry Lieber over a balcony until he agreed to sell his shares.
Unbelievable.
The story just keeps getting wilder and wilder.
It reads like a Shangri-La's song.
Yes,
it really does. Drama.
There's so much going on. Surprise, surprise, Goldner rang up even more gambling debts and owed money to the shady people. Like he had done with two previous record labels, he had to levy Redbirds as collateral. He all but handed it off to the mafia, and in 1966, it was shut down. This had crushing repercussions for the Shangri-Las. Their masters were sold off to repay Goldner's debts. It was at this time that Margie Ganser left the group to go back to school. The remaining Shangri-Las tried to bounce back as best as they could. In December 1966, they signed with Mercury Records. Their first single for their new label, Sweet Sounds of Summer, was released in January of the following year. Despite their best efforts, it failed. Music had changed so much since Leader of the Pack. Psychedelia was all the rage. The Byrds set the curve with 8 Miles High. Donovan hit his stride with Sunshine Superman. Bob Dylan released Blonde on Blonde. And of course, the Beatles released Revolver. The Shangri-La's doo-wop influenced sound just couldn't keep up with the changing times. George Morton left working with them to produce Vanilla Fudge. Mercury tried their best to update the girls' image, putting them in more mature clothes and styling Mary's hair like a 1940s movie star. She hated it. It felt silly and fake. They did exclusive radio interviews for the Armed Forces Network, but this was a miss as well. Anti-Vietnam War sentiment grew. After another failed single, Take the Time, Mercury refused to record anymore. Stuck with a label that had no interest in them or helping them acclimate to the current times, the Shangri-Las couldn't go home anymore. In 1968, they had no choice but to break up. You can never. The next three decades of Shangri-La's history are what George Harrison called the Sue Me, Sue You Blues. Mary was bitter about how the Shangri-Las ended and how the industry used her. Quote, "My mother kind of signed my life away when I was 14. I'm laughing. 30 years of litigation. There's a storeroom of litigation up to the ceiling. That's one of the reasons I walked away from the music. The litigation was much thicker than the music. I couldn't get near another record label for 10 years. This was part out of resentment, part out of legal obligation. Though the Shangri-Las weren't together, their contract with Mercury was still binding. Even if the girls wanted to, they couldn't record with anyone else until their 10-year contract was up. This was terribly difficult for Mary, as for all those 10 years, she was still recognized in the streets and asked about getting the group back together. They didn't own their music anymore. They didn't even have the rights to their name. That's right. Since no one had officially registered the Shangri-La's name, promoter Dick Fox put together a fake Shangri-La's. The same thing happened to the coasters, the platters, and the zombies. Outraged, the girls took Dick to court. In a rare statement, Betty said, quote, "We're not teenagers anymore, and we don't have to take it anymore, and we're not going to take it anymore." The case wouldn't be settled until 1989. Tragically, Marianne Ganser would not live to see the day she could legally sing again.
On the night of March 14, 1970, Marianne went to visit Betty Weiss. As Marianne was left alone for a time at the apartment, it's impossible to say exactly what happened, but according to her death reports, she overdosed on either heroin or barbiturates. It took longer than usual for help to arrive, as Betty didn't have a telephone in her apartment. She had to leave again to go find someone with one. Marianne passed away early in the morning on March 15th. For many years, it was incorrectly reported that Marianne died of encephalitis, swelling of the brain caused by a mosquito bite. This story was even repeated in a Rolling Stone article. Dressed in Black devotes a whole chapter to thoroughly debunking this myth. It published Marianne's death certificate, which makes no mention of a mosquito bite, and what little Marianne's mother and brother said. Marianne's passing was always off-limits in interviews. Betty has never spoken about what happened that day, and neither has Mary. To New York Magazine in 2007, she simply said, "I'll leave it that way. It doesn't matter much anymore." Though the Shangri-La's would never truly reunite after Marianne's passing, there was still the opportunity to get together when their Mercury contract expired. It turns out the ladies were deeply revered by some unlikely fans. New York punk rockers.
When I say I'm in love, you best believe I'm in love, L-U-V.
That's the late David Johansen quoting Give Him a Great Big Kiss on the New York Dolls song Looking for a Kiss. Listening to the Ramones, you can hear how Joey might have picked up his signature nasally affect from Mary. One of our favorite groups, Blondie, recorded Out in the Streets in 1975. The Shangri-La's reunited at legendary punk club CBGB's in 1977. They were backed by Lenny Kaye and J.D. Doherty of the Patti Smith Group. The show received rave reviews from old fans and new kids alike. The surviving Shangri-La's did return to the studio after this, but nothing came of it. "It just didn't feel right," Mary said. They played one last show in New Jersey in June of 1989 to much less fanfare. The Shangri-La's were only active for about 5 years, recording no more than 30 songs. The whole thing was said and done by the time Mary was 18. After the Shangri-La's broke up, she moved out of her mother's house. She ran off to San Francisco, the land of flower children, and immersed herself in hippie culture. When she returned to New York, she worked in interior design before becoming the project manager at an architectural firm. At one point, she went by Mary Weiss Stokes. It's the name she appears with in that documentary where Greg Shaw calls the Shangri-La's tough sluts. Mary and her husband at that time separated. Margie Ganser married her husband, Bill Dorst, in 1972. She passed away on July 28, 1996, of breast cancer. Her ashes were scattered over her twin Marianne's grave. After her marriage to Tracy's father ended, Betty Weiss remarried to Jeremy Storch, organ player for The Vagrants. She can be seen with Jeremy on the cover of his album, From a Naked Window. She and Jeremy split up in the late 70s after he found God and became a rabbi.
Oh, wow. Didn't see that coming.
Yeah. She remarried once again and worked for a brewery and a cosmetics company. Despite being the only member of the Shangri-La's to rejoin the music industry, Mary notably refused to participate in Dressed in Black. As a researcher and musician committed to reassessing the Shangri-La's undervalued role in the history of popular music, "I found Weiss's position tremendously disappointing, of course," Lisa said. George Morton and recording engineers Brooks Arthur and Rod McBrien all tried to change her mind, to no avail. Quote, "But I also understood and respected it, recognizing that it was deeply rooted in her experiences as a teenage performer contracted to an industry notorious for consuming its young. any engagement with music or talking about the Shangri-Las that Mary did was strictly on her own terms and no one else's.
The Shangri-La's influence has lasted through the rest of the 20th century and into the 21st. The Go-Go's covered Remember, Twisted Sister recorded a very 80s version of Leader of the Pack, this time from Jimmy's point of view.
Have you seen that video?
I have.
It's hysterical. It's the most 80s thing you'll ever see in your life.
Yes, it really is. And the hair. The hair of 80s things always gets me.
The gag with the car, like...
That was really clever. I mean, kind of clever, also very silly, but also clever. Mm-hmm. You have to give it to them. Kim Gordon of Sonic Youth modeled her singing voice after Mary's. Little Trouble Girl was her ultimate homage to the Shangri-Las.
Remember, Mother, we were close, very, very close. You taught me how to fit in good. Flirt and love, be understood. Curl my hair and eyelash.
And of course, we can't forget Amy Winehouse. She's an honorary doll at this point. She cited the Shangri-Las as one of her main influences for Back to Black. Quote, I love the drama. I love the atmosphere. I love the sound effects. They wrote the most depressing song ever. I can never go home anymore. When me and my boyfriend finished, I used to listen to that song on repeat. When singing Back to Black live, she sometimes traded the song's bridge for the chorus of Remember. In 2007, Bad for Lashes released their own homage to the Shangri-Las, What's a Girl to Do? After 40 years, Mary Weiss finally got back into the studio. With the help of Miriam Linna of the Cramps, she released her only studio album, Dangerous Game. She still rocks her signature black pants, leather jacket, and side-swept blonde hair on the cover. Her voice got huskier with age, but she still has her signature nasally tone and teenage attitude.
When you held me close, that's when I knew, chilled me through and through. I couldn't let you go, I couldn't let it show. And this whole world's unfair, I know it's true. What can I do? One day you'll be free, you'll come running to me. Till then, my heart beat, baby.
When asked why she made another record, she said, quote, music is home to me. It always was. Music was my life as a child growing up, and it got me through most of the things in my life. And it feels like where I belong. In 2019, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inducted Leader of the Pack into its singles category. The next year, two separate Shangri-La songs became runaway hits on TikTok. First was Margie and Mary Ann's spoken word bit in Give Him a Break, Big Kiss.
Tell him that I love, tell him that I care, tell him that I'll always be there.
What color are his eyes?
I don't know, he's always wearing shades.
Is he tall?
Well, I gotta look up.
Yeah, well I hear he's bad.
He's good bad, but he's not evil.
Remember's famous Oh No's became one of the most used TikTok audios of all time.
I looked at it really quickly before sitting down to film. On TikTok alone, it's been used in over 17 million videos.
Oh, wow.
And that's not counting all the stuff that made it to Instagram and Facebook.
I'm always a little sad when, like, these TikTok songs go viral that no one ever questions where it comes from.
Mm.
Because I don't think anyone knows that this, like, oh no sound comes from any song or anything. It could be from everywhere because it is so short and cropped down.
Mm-hmm.
But I really like how they're having this, like, resurgence in a way.
Mary Weiss passed on January 19th, 2024 of COPD at age 75. Tributes came pouring in from musicians, icons, and all the coolest people you knew. As of us recording this episode in April 2024, Betty Weiss is the only surviving member. She lives a very private life nowadays. No one bother her, please. As teenage girls in the adult male-dominated music industry, the Shangri-Las had very little agency over what happened to their own career. They were written off as just a girl group, suffering from that Rolling Stone expectation that groups have to write their own songs and play instruments to have talent. The Shangri-Las did have talent. They could play and write, but they chose to sing. They chose to break down barriers by being unapologetically teenage girls. Chewing gum, wearing pants, gossiping about each other's boyfriends, ignoring parents' wishes, and having the courage to feel every emotion deeply. Even today, teens are the heart and soul of pop culture. The ripped and studded love their tough girl vulnerability just the same as the hair bows and ponytails did. We'll never forget these leaders of the pack. I'm gonna get it right this time.
Okay.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s. We hope you enjoyed our journey through the short but brilliant life of leaders of the pack, the Shangri-Las.
As always, we're Emma.
And Abby.
Your hosts, and we're thrilled to have you with us on this groovy adventure. Remember, the spirit of these trailblazing ladies lives on in each one of us, inspiring us to embrace our individuality, creativity, and passion for change.
If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review the show on your favorite streaming platform. Your feedback means the world to us, and it helps others discover the magic of these legendary dolls.
As always, we'd like to thank special friend of the show, Michael Teggio, for the wonderful intro song. Until next time, keep the music loud, the fashion groovy, and the spirit of the 60s and 70s alive in your hearts.
Peace,
love,
and rock and roll.